Und fisch, 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 fisch. I've gone fishing, hook, sinker, and line. I said fish, 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 fish. Boy, I'm going fishing just to ease my mind.
Okie dokie pokey.
You know, some folks say,
yeah. But I don't agree with any of that. Fishing Frank here, rubbing the chair across from me, and RJ conspicuously missing from action today. But we will endeavor to figure out where he's at and what he's doing somewhere before we finalize things here. Kind of a weird day, Robert.
Very weird. You know, the weather's been pretty funky. We got that tropical low kind of building over us, so it's making for some very unusual weather.
I don't know if it's supposed to come into the northern Gulf up in the Big Bend and then dip down and then go across and go up in New Orleans somewhere like that,
right?
But in the meantime, it's just throwing a bunch of rain at us.
And it's just weird though, because it's like you can't really necessarily watch the radar, because one cell is dissipating and then the other one looks like it's dissipating, and a minute later it doubles in size.
Yeah, and what's weird is they're not really moving a lot. When they blow up and it just kind of forms there and then just gets really big over the top of you. But I can pretty much guarantee we've got a lot of rain coming at us. I was just looking on the radar here and it's rainy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't really looked to see what this weekend was going to do.
I haven't looked at the far forecast. Just a couple of days is all I looked at.
I honestly hadn't really thought about it, but I guess we ought to look at the weekend and see what's going to come out.
Yeah, it'd probably be a good idea.
Let's see. Saturday, showers. Sunday, showers.
So Friday,
showers.
Normal summertime pattern. The weatherman are right back at it again. They got a 50% chance of being right.
So it's 50-50. It's going to rain this week. Good God.
Wow, imagine that in July in Florida. Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, that kind of clears that up. One thing with weather-wise that always affects the fishing in the harbor is the water flow in the Peace River. So I went to fishandfranks.com, weather and tides button, and clicked the Arcadia Peace River button. And it's kind of the one I got memorized, so I know what it means for the harbor. And we have 1,360 cubic feet per second coming down the river. It is up to almost 6 foot. So no red tide in the harbor for right now.
Nope.
That's pretty much impossible. We've got enough fresh water floating on top. Isn't it weird how fresh and salt water don't mix?
Not very easily.
The fresh water floats on the top. The salt water sinks to the bottom.
Yep.
We get a lot of people saying, well, I'm just going to put the bucket in the canal and, you know, keep my shrimp alive because I just got back down. And, you know, and I'm like, no, it worked 2 months ago, but it doesn't work now.
Right.
Buckets that float on the surface are in the direct sunlight. So they're 130-140 degrees. It's like locking something in your car. You're going to cook the shrimp in there. You could just literally boil them in that bucket sitting on the surface on the water. Then combined with the rain we're having, where the first, I would say, 3 inches to a foot of the water right now is pretty fresh.
Yes.
So fresh water, which kills shrimp because they're very much a saltwater creature. You always tell when they die from lack of salt, they get real stiff.
Yeah.
You can kind of see their little gills are still moving and stuff, but they just can't move. That's why we used to take salt tablets when I was a kid. Nowadays, people drink Gatorade with a lot of sugar and salt mixed in with it. But they would just give us a salt tablet.
Right.
And when your muscles started getting stiff when you're outside, because as you sweat, you lose the salt, and your muscles get stiff. Well, it happens to shrimp on a much more intense scale.
Yeah. Yeah, you think that Charlie horse in the back of your calf is bad, picture it in your whole body.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty much what happens.
I guess that would be the best explanation.
Yeah.
Right now, this is adding a lot of brown tint to the harbor with the Peace River flowing the way it is. So, time for pink lures. Time to get over your I'm a guy. I'm not throwing pink. Okay.
Right.
This is the time to get out the pretty pink stuff.
Yes.
And if you can't do it and you just want to have fish in a boat, let your wife throw the pink stuff. Yeah. Let your girlfriend throw the pink stuff. Because this is the number one time of year for throwing pink lures.
Yeah.
Right as we get that water coming down, it's all kind of brown tinted. Something about pink. Pink and white mixed up together. Pink and green mixed together. You know, you can do the nuclear chicken colors, the white and pink. Rainbow trout colors work real good because it's always got a nice pink and blue white mix. It's why we have so many rainbow trout colored lures here at Fish and Frank's, where most people in the South don't stock rainbow trout colors because we don't have rainbow trout fishing here. But
right.
I'm 100% convinced that for about a month in the spring and a month in the fall, absolutely you got to throw pink. And if you're a guy and you don't want to throw that bright pink lure, get the rainbow trout color patterns.
Yeah. Yeah, and it works exceptionally well on so many different species. I mean, we get guys that catch cobia, snapper, the snook, the trout. I mean, everything will eat that. You know, and I personally noticed, like, you catch some of the smaller trout in the midpoint of the harbor, let's say the middle to lower east side, once the tannins have moved in. They still get a little bit of that goldish hue to them, but it seems like the white gets a little bit of that pinkish amber color to it, where it's similar.
Really,
to a rainbow
I never
trout.
Thought about
it,
that.
It's a little bit of a reach, but if you look at it, it's not that dark amber color like when they're up in the Peace River above 75. But it's definitely not that white color that it is during the winter time.
That's a really good point. Never thought of. You know, we do have fish that are actually turning that kind of off white to pink, you know, hues on some fish, but man, it really works.
Oh, amazingly
well. So, there you go, guys. Good lure choice, you know, and these are things that have evolved over time, where we start out with one thing, and you start out trying it because you're absolutely out of stuff, like a company gives you all these different lures, and you use all the cool colors, and you get down to the very last one, and it's pink, and you're like, okay, well, let's see if there's some sissy fish out here that really like pink, and all of a sudden you're catching a lot of fish. And it works really good, and then it doesn't work for a while, then it works really good, and over time you kind of figure out it's that light stand water. Mm-hmm. So I would say one of the things, evolution of stuff, you know, people talk about humans affecting climate change, and the truth of the matter is, with, you know, weather science people, they rely on the government to get paid. And if they want their funding and their grant money, they have to say whatever the government wants them to say.
Sure.
And the truth of the matter is that there's just as many people not on the government payroll saying that humans aren't doing this to the climate as there is people making the climate warmer. Because me, of course, as everybody knows, I'm a big fan of global warming. Maybe it'll go too far one day, but without it I wouldn't have been born, because I was born in Illinois. Robert, you were born in Indiana.
Yep.
And then you went to Arizona and all that. But if without global warming we would never have been born, because there'd still be a mile and a half of ice on Illinois and Indiana.
Exactly.
Glacier lakes. So if you're from anywhere north of Kentucky, you owe your life to global warming.
Sure.
So just point of fact, it's not fictional, it's not a guess, that's the fact. Now here's something less of a fact, but maybe on direct observation science we can see where humans are affecting something. And it kind of started, Robert was mentioning about rattlesnakes. Now some of the rattlesnakes are doing some different stuff, right?
Right, like your eastern diamondback, which is here in Florida. You know, one, it's rare anyway, but it's unusual for them to rattle as much as, say, some of the western rattlesnakes that I'm very familiar with. You know, you come across a western diamondback or a Mojave rattlesnake, heck, you can be 10 feet away from it, and it'll start buzzing and let you know you're getting way too close. Versus an eastern diamondback, they've, in the last, you know, probably 20, 30 years, have really gotten very quiet. They super rely on their camouflage and their stealthiness and their ability to hopefully disappear into their surroundings and prefer not to buzz.
And I think it's a simple matter, because the rattlesnakes here, if they start setting off that rattle, somebody goes, oh my God, rattlesnake, whip out the shovel or the gun or whatever it is and kill it.
Sure, absolutely.
So just by human selection, not natural selection, which it could be a form of natural selection, the ones who are quieter by nature and don't rattle as soon as they see a predator or a threat, who just sit more quiet and wait, are going to live longer, and therefore they're going to breed more and pass that trait on down to their young. Whereas the ones with rattle, 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 get away from me, ooh, I'm dead, they didn't right. go on to breed.
Right. You know? They didn't pass on those genes.
They didn't pass on that gene. Yeah. But the ones who are quiet, they pass that quiet trait on to their babies.
Correct.
Now, what does that have to do with fishing? Well, we're seeing some of this with white bait was the first thing we noticed in it. And we're starting to see it with some other types of fish.
Mm-hmm.
Bait fish who dimple at the top and run along the surface get cast netted, sabiki rigged. They get taken.
Skewered by a bird.
Yeah, they get eaten by birds, all this other kind of stuff. So they're not passing that genetic trait along, escape bait, by running up to the top and running around, dimpling across the surface. And we're finding tons of bait fish in the harbor that no one knew they were there because they hugged the bottom.
Yeah.
So if a bait fish goes up on the surface and exposes itself, people go in there and take them for bait. But the ones who are hugging the bottom, they've been spawning and breeding and multiplying because they haven't been taken for bait.
Right.
You can't find them as easy. So if you figure they're passing that trait along, now some of their babies are going to have the old traits where they go to the top, and that's why we're seeing schools of bait on the top.
Sure.
But every year we see more and more schools of bait that are not showing themselves. And we're getting all this bait and all this stuff in the harbor that no one knows about.
Right.
And occasionally somebody with a very expensive fish finder, depth finder thing, bottom machine, goes, oh my God, and they throw a cast net and they come up with tons of bait.
Right.
And now we're finding out that humans may be affecting certain species, not that we've changed their habits, but we take the ones that are easy for us to find and leave the ones that aren't easy to find, and those are the ones that are making babies and passing that trait along to more and more of the offspring.
It definitely makes sense. I mean, it's a really interesting theory. And like you said, you know, observation science sometimes is a lot better or easier to understand than trying to sit there and observe or evaluate something for decades, you know, with data.
Well, the one thing about it is sometimes 1 + 2 = 3.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes 1 + 2 = 4, but mostly in government labs.
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah. It's very, you know, if someone goes to college in today's world, they come out 1 + 2 = 4, 1 + 2 = 7.5, or something like that. But for those of us who didn't get educated beyond our intelligence, 1 + 2 = 3, most of the time.
Absolutely.
Or maybe 2, but I'm going to say 3. So it could be we are affecting stuff like that. Now, speaking of cause and effect, what is the effect of the river water coming down the harbor going on with the fishing right now?
It's actually doing 2 things. One, you know, we always have that first initial hard push out of the river, because I think last week when we did this, I want to say the river was below 300 feet.
Below 300 cubic feet per second.
Yeah,
and
which is
it was like
a standstill.
2 foot. Yeah, it was. There was no water coming down.
So what happens is when you get this real hard push where the river raises up, you know, it doubles, triples in some instances in a matter of a couple of days. There's something, me personally, I believe that the fish sense something like a smell in the water of that change, because they actually, some of these fish will actually push their way upriver, in particular your tarpon and your snook especially. You'll notice that they go to the mouths of these creeks or to these culvert pipes in some of these canals in the neighborhoods, and they sit there and
wait. Oh man, the snook
wait.
Just had, if there's a culvert pipe or a spillway and there's a lot of stuff, water flowing out of it, as soon as they sense that, and it, let's break it down. If, let's say you're standing out in your backyard and somebody's grilling a steak, you know, a half a block down or something like that, you can smell that coming through the air.
Absolutely.
And fish are the same way in the water. If there's something happening upwind from them or up current, as the case would be, they can smell that coming at them. Fish have a remarkable sense of smell. Now, if you go underwater to try and test this theory, when you get your head underwater, just, you know, close your mouth because you don't want to get water, and then breathe deep through your nose. And you'll be able to smell all those different changes in the water. And
I can't give a straight face for that one.
Like the old fish call?
Yeah, pretty much.
Put your mouth on the little end, you know, put your head underwater, take deep breath, and blow soft breaths.
Yeah.
You know, catch lots of fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, probably not.
I can't imagine somebody going out there, sticking their head underwater, and breathing deep through their nose.
I can.
Yeah, well.
I think they have disclaimers on TV commercials.
No, I'm going to suggest
not
go
really
ahead.
Made to drive underwater. Really? You actually had to put that disclaimer in there?
Jeez. Toothpaste tubes work better if you squeeze from the bottom to the top.
Exactly.
Once I read that on the toothpaste tubes, I said, eh.
Yeah, he's done.
Yeah, the U.S. will probably have to fall at least once.
Yeah, there's a car commercial on this radio station all the time, and it says, open 7 days a week, including Sundays. It's like, are your customers really? Oh, wait a minute. Yes, they are.
Did you want to join us, Carl?
Huh?
We're taping a show for Thursday.
He's got food.
Oh, I got food.
Okay.
Priorities. I don't know.
Hang on just a minute. Okay, and so anyway, I don't remember where we were. Where were we before they walked in?
Talking about the fish and the smells and the water and
so
stuff like that.
Anyway, I think that the smell travels to them in the water the same way smell would travel to us through the air. It just makes sense. And they run up. Now, this works for the first 1 to 2 days of the water flowing.
Right.
Because you got grasshoppers, bugs,
frogs, lizards,
small fish. Because any mud puddle down here that has water in it for a month or so gets loaded up with tiny minnows, tadpoles, frogs, insect larvae, everything a fish is looking for to eat.
Absolutely.
And as it gets washed out of these pipes or over the spillways, those fish are just laid up there free food.
Absolutely. It's a buffet.
It's a buffet right there. Same thing with the river. Mm-hmm. When you go from, like it was, a little less than 2 feet up to 6, so you've put an extra 4 feet of water coming down there in less than 2 days.
Right.
And that's just pushing a lot of that stuff. The current picked up so strong that a lot of this fish, bugs, whatever, minnows, they can't hold their place in the current, so they just get washed down, and that's what the fish go up to feed on.
Right.
Now, the longer it goes, the less of an effect this would have.
Right.
All the stuff gets washed out, and there's really, after that, nothing coming down. So I would say the fish would probably move out. What would you? They would just go, okay, there's nothing left here, let's go somewhere else.
Yeah, I think they scatter about and mostly move back down south, heading out towards the lower part of the harbor / intercoastal and even the beaches. Because, I mean, you've said it many, many times. I mean, let's say a fish just swimming at a mediocre pace swims at 4 miles an hour. Along with the tide sometimes moves them up to 6 miles an hour, you know, in 24 hours, even in 20 hours, I mean, that fish could be to...
What's 20 times 4?
80.
So it can be 80 miles away in...
Yeah. I mean, basically, he could be in Marco Island
right.
in 24 hours if he wanted to. At just a,
if you're moving 4 miles an hour and you go for 20 hours,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I would say... You know, 4 miles an hour for 10 hours a day would be easy for a fish because they got nothing to do for 24 hours. Let's say they slept for 6 hours a day or 8 hours a day, still leaves, you know, a long time.
Right, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, a fish can go from Harbor Heights, even Arcadia, for example, all the way down to the beach in basically a half a day. You know, and that's lowballing it. You know, so there's a lot of potential for these fish to move up there pretty quickly and then move out once that food and current starts to dissipate a little bit more. You know, and you've got so many different slow-moving fish that get displaced right with that first initial go, but once that water kind of sustains the speed, those fish can start to regroup.
If you figure 18 hours a day, right, times 4 miles an hour,
right,
that's 72 miles.
Right. So they could almost be to Tampa Bay, basically.
Yeah, in one day of meandering along, you know, they could be 60 to 80 miles away.
Yeah.
In a day.
Right.
And that's with sleeping for 8 hours. And if you got nothing to do but swim all day, it's not, it wouldn't be that hard.
It's not much of a stretch. Not at all.
So, yeah, that's pretty strange to think about that. Okay, I can have a fish in Harbor Heights, and later in 18 hours later, that fish could be pretty much in Fort Myers, Marco Island, Sarasota, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of weird when you think about it. You know, but once you think about it, you're like, okay, that's very practical, very realistic. You know, so to have those fish move up on the river right now, I'd say it's doing probably pretty good.
Now have the, I think the tilapia have spawned, and there should be a bunch of tilapia babies, Mayan cichlid, little baby Mayan cichlids, tilapia, all that stuff. That
yeah.
I haven't, it's usually about every 3 years, and I think next year we should get a whole bunch of them. I think it was 2-3 years ago that we had that big flood of tilapia cichlids come down the river.
Yeah, but usually that one, for some reason, and I don't understand this, why it works out, but it seems to be that late August when we get those couple days of like a high pressure or something like what we've got going on now, where it takes the river from, say, 6 or 7 feet to flood stage in a couple days.
Yeah, from like a normal flow right now. It's just at a normal flow.
Yeah.
But then once it hits flood stage, they really can't hold themselves in the current.
Right. It seems like they're a little bit stronger swimmer than, say, the mosquito fish or the gar or the armored catfish. Those are the ones that kind of get pushed down on this first little flush. But they're a little bit
stronger.
Along
with the tiny minnows and bugs and
stuff. Yeah, that's why mosquito fish and all the other little critters, absolutely. But then you're bigger fish or stronger swimmers, I think that they get really pushed hard on that next one.
So if we get, like, say, a tropical storm goes over and dumps 6 inches of rain a day on us, then that would be the catalyst to bring down those smaller actual bait fish size fish.
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
3-inch to 6-inch bait fish.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good point. I didn't think of it that way. Kind of talking it out as we went. But yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So,
how about a little bit of a fishing report?
Fishing report's been very good, very weird. I mean, so many people are getting chased off by these thunderstorms, but the guys have actually been catching a handful of nicer redfish on the very lower east or west wall.
Isn't it like about August when they come through the rift in the space-time continuum and come back into the harbor?
Yeah, they come back from that disappearing act that they do that's makes Copperfield look like nothing.
Yeah, I mean, David Copperfield stands in the middle of a bear stage and disappears and makes tanks disappear, and then it's nothing compared to what the redfish do.
Right.
Because somewhere around August, the harbor will load with redfish. It's been going on for, what, 5 years or more now?
At least, yeah.
Where all of a sudden, for a while, and we've looked for them in the backcountry, we've looked for them. And these are smaller redfish, so it's not like they're out in the Gulf of Mexico. The snook we know go out in the Gulf. A couple guys dropped some GoPros down on some of the reefs, and solid snook right now.
That'd be cool to see.
The power poles, Helens. Guy was in with a little bit of video the other day showing me, and there's just 1,000 snook in view of the camera.
And
they're all on the reefs.
That was a big grouper that I just looked. No, that was a 15-pound snook that just railed you.
Yeah.
No, I'm like, yeah, more than likely.
Yeah, it's just funny how many big snook are on these near shore reefs right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get them because we're not rigged for them. They're not doing the bait for them. Now, you go down to Marco Island, places like that, they fish for them every day on the near shore reefs.
Yeah.
And they get some big fish down there.
Some really good fish down there with that.
But the redfish, I don't believe they're out there.
No.
I really don't. I don't believe they're out in the Gulf. Not these little ones, the slot size and the under.
Yeah, these are like 16 to 22, 24 inches.
I would say 12
fish.
To 22 inches.
Okay.
8 to 22 inches.
Okay.
Where are they hiding?
I have no idea. I mean, the ones I'm hearing about are in that like 16 to 22, 24 inch range.
Yeah, they're the ones that are about a year old.
And they're catching them on cut bait, mostly up underneath the bushes, just still fishing as much as possible, waiting for that fish to come out of the bushes and grab a hold of what they're looking, you know, what they're ideally wanting, I guess.
So, is there any mackerel left in the harbor?
There is a handful, but they're incidental bycatch. If you're going to go out there and, like, if you say you're going to take your time running down to the southern part of the harbor, it's not going to hurt you at all to troll a couple spoons or a couple small lipped plugs behind the boat, and you'll probably pick up at least one or two. But, you know, they're not good numbers, but they're definitely bigger fish. You know, they're running in that 20 to 22 inch range, which is pretty darn good for a harbor Spanish mackerel.
Right. You know, now, so. One fish that's out there right now that I'm hearing about is spade fish.
Yeah. Yeah, those have been at Ponce de Leon. The Alligator Creek Reef has had quite a bit on them. And then even Marker 4, which is right there off of Boquilla. That's been holding quite a few spade fish. And the ones that are at Marker 4 are mixed from, say, 4-inch fish up to, like, say, 10-inch fish, but lots of numbers, versus, say, the ones that are coming through Ponce are running in that 10 to 12-inch range, but far fewer. And then the Alligator Creek Reef, depending for some reason, I think obviously tide plays a role in it, because that incoming water is definitely higher salinity.
That incoming tide really seems to be the one that the spade fish want to feed on. But and Danger Reef, the Alligator Creek Reef, I used to catch a lot of spade fish there.
Right.
You know, because I used to go out and target them, because I knew they were there, so I would go out and, especially when the kid's on the boat, go out and I take any kind of light rods that I have, I tie a crappie jig on, and usually 10, 15 pound leader, because it's really hard to get anything bigger than that through the eye of a crappie jig.
Right.
And put a little tiny piece of shrimp meat on a marabou crappie jig, just a little hair jig, toss it down there and just kind of pretend I'm jigging for crappie. And a lot of times I would take my crappie rods out there, and the kids would just have a blast in those, because it's one after the other, after the other, after the other, and just catching them, letting them go, catching them, letting them go. And then occasionally you get a great big one on that takes a while to get one in, something like 14 up. Yeah.
They turn sideways in the water, and I mean, you're reeling in a basically a cast iron skillet at that point on its side.
So I think if you were to go, like, say, the Alligator Creek Reef, incoming tide, and take two bags of frozen shrimp with you. Now, when you get out there, take one and start dicing it into little tiny, tiny slivers. I mean, almost like you would think of slicing a tomato up in little pieces, and scrape them into like a bowl or something, scatter them out on the water, and just get them out there. And let everybody fish, you know, you bottom fishing or whatever, and then have a couple rods rigged up with number 6 hooks, or, and that's little tiny, not like 6-aught. These are little tiny number 6. They'll fit on your...
Something you'd use for crappie or even perch. Perch would actually be more appropriate with that size hook.
Exactly. And I'm not using sinkers. If I'm using anything, it's a little tiny split shot, because I don't want it to go past the fish, because a lot of times they're hanging out in the middle of the water column or even up close to the surface. So if it's too heavy, it drops too quick and the fish never see it's there.
Right.
And then you got to start using floats or whatever. But there's a little 16th ounce, 32nd ounce crappie jigs. By the time you put the line on it, the line acts as kind of a parachute, slows it way down, especially in salt water, which is a lot more buoyant. And then all of a sudden you feel a little bump, so you start setting hook, and then it just starts going. Once you get them going, you don't want to chum anymore. The chumming with the little tiny pieces of shrimp is cool, but you don't want to give them food-sized pieces.
No.
And these are little guys.
You don't want them to get full.
You don't want them to get full. You want them to actually really want to feed on this. So you got to really make some tiny little slices.
Yeah.
And the trick to putting the shrimp on the crappie jig is peeling the shell and then slicing it in less than quarter-inch pieces. And just put it on the point of the hook. If you put it on and bring it around the bend of the hook, they're going to come up behind it and just pull that piece of shrimp meat off of it. They're not actually going to get the point. So remember, the point of the hook has to be covered in the shrimp meat.
Right.
And the little jig with the hair, the marabou hair or the feathers or whatever you've got on it, is to get their attention. And then they're going to try and grab that little piece of shrimp meat off of it. But you want them to bite the hook. You don't want them, you know, pulling it off the back. So, because they will.
No, absolutely. I mean, and the craziest part is, you know, it's actually a targetable fish in the Carolinas and Georgia and even Jacksonville.
They get up in the 20-inch range up there.
Yeah, but it's considered a very much a
game fish.
A game fish slash table fish, you know, and down here, not so much. You know,
well, we don't usually get the size that's big enough to eat. One out of 500 that I catch is what I would flay up for on the dinner table.
Right.
And it's kind of a darker meat. It's good tasting.
Kind of a grayish off-white, like eggshell almost look to it.
Yeah. And there's not a lot of meat for... It's like trying to clean a Jack Crevel. Is a Jack Crevel good to eat? Yes. Is it a lot of work for what you get? Absolutely. Same thing with a spade fish.
Same way with a triggerfish.
Triggerfish, spadefish, flounder.
I think triggerfish, when I saw you clean that one years ago, you cleaned several spadefish, obviously, but to me it looked very much similar to the triggerfish, where you're pretty much just getting almost just a back strap off of them.
Yeah, you cut down. I always like take it right by the backbone with the knife. And then if you've ever flayed a flounder where you make a slice, then you work the meat off, that's kind of what I do with those fish.
Right.
Because if you just try and slab them, there's nothing there.
No, you lose a lot of meat doing that.
You really want to kind of lift it up and let your knife go along, just easing the meat off of the fish. And it's a pretty thin little fillet.
Right.
Very tasty, but thin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty thin. But is it good? Yes. Is it worth all the work? Maybe.
But from a standpoint of having a good time, whether you've got new adult anglers that you're trying to introduce them into kind of some relatively non-stop action, or you've got kids that need the relatively non-stop action to keep them entertained out there, it's one of the most perfect fish around here for that.
Yeah, because you can't go out right now. You're not going to find the big schools of trout or even ladyfish. You know, you can, but you're going to work for it.
You're going to work for it, really.
You know, yeah, I would say for the ladyfish, probably around Gasparilla Pass.
Even then.
Maybe the flats over there.
Even then, they've been tricky. It's been like a daylight thing, and that first hour of daylight's about your only option, and then they kind of really hard to find after that point. You know, I mean, if I had two species to choose from out of all the stuff we have here just to have some good action, I'm going with the spadefish being number one. You just got to find them on the right spot, because they are they're a pretty serious schooling fish. They're like permit, the way they swim and act. They like to suspend in the water column, like you said.
Over structure. Or behind a piling. They kind of remind me of white bait almost that way.
But they pick a spot. They'll pick that one spot. So like, you've got a mile long piece of Alligator Creek Reef, and you might find three separate schools of those spadefish sitting in one area
or the other, whatever it is, yeah.
And nothing else. And so you got to kind of find them, but once you find them, it's a blast. And then the other one would be all the small sharks and even the medium sized sharks that have been around. You know, at least it's guaranteed rod bending, bait stealing, bait running action.
Yeah,
you know, those two right now are really good because we got a lot of kids that are on summer vacation that live here but also come down to visit grandma, grandpa, their uncles or whatever, and they're new to fishing in general, and you want to introduce them to some fun stuff, you know, because, you know, I've talked about it, you've written about it, I've written about it.
I'm going to throw mangrove snappers into the mix.
Yeah, but they're starting to leave. They're starting to, the bigger ones are starting to head out.
Yeah,
offshore.
But I would think right now you could still probably find some snappers around Cape Hayes off that sandbar if you had a boat.
Yeah.
Maybe the Placita Trestle where you could actually, you know, get targetable numbers. But then again, it really, but still all of them, we're still trying to find them, because if you can find the schools, you're just great nonstop action.
Absolutely.
But I don't know. Now, Ponce de Leon, I know I can find some there, because when you're standing on the fishing pier at Ponce de Leon, you look across the channel, you're going to see a channel marker there right before the trees start. It just sticks out just a few feet. That's the actual, you know, the last one in the markers. When you look out towards the harbor, you see all the channel markers coming in. The very last one on the far side, it's all hollowed out around that marker. Yeah. There's a deep pocket there.
Yeah.
And if there's no boats coming and you can cast that far, you can drop it in there with a small hook and a piece of shrimp meat. Not a live shrimp, but shrimp meat, peeled, soft meat on a hook, and you'll catch bait fish. They just load up there at that marker. That's why I say, you know, I would do some random marker checks, like you said, at 4 or 6, maybe even 5.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of them at 5 before. I haven't seen them there recently, but, you know, they are around. But it's worth looking for them, because once you do find them, and just like permit, there's times where, you know, you said there's little tails and dorsal fin is sticking right out of the water, so you see these little tiny swords sticking out. That's them.
Why wouldn't they go to the Placita Trestle when so many of the other fish, like the snappers and all that, go there? And I never see spade fish there.
Very
once
rarely.
Once in a blue moon.
Very,
I mean,
rarely.
It's such an odd thing. You would think that would be a great location for them, that they would, you know, come in through the passes, hang out there. But, you know,
it's almost like it's a lost one that's hanging out there, if there is one. You know, you see one. Then you see maybe two, but that's it.
I don't know of any piers that actually get good populations of spade fish.
25 years ago, Sharkey's Pier used to get them on occasion, but it'd be like for a day, and then it was over, and then it'd be another day, and it'd be over. It was quick. But, and even then, they weren't by the hundreds the way you see on some of the channel markers and some of the small reefs, but you'd see dozens.
Right.
And nothing anymore. It's weird. I don't understand it myself.
Yeah, I can't even speculate why a fish that likes structure so much the way a spade fish does, except they like hanging out over the top of it.
The only thing
kind of reminds you of an American red snapper, the big snappers everybody goes out to get.
Right.
They don't like being in the reef, around the reef. They like being over it.
Right.
They'll literally, you'll come up and it'll look like a big hump, and it's not actually structure. It's just a big pile of these American reds showing up on the fish finder as a big piece of structure because they found something and they just stack up over the top of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the one thing, like, as we're talking about this more, that makes sense with the spade fish is main reason why we probably see them more numbers up inside the harbor is their primary food source likes that extremely brackish water is those little jellyfish.
Oh, they do like eating those clear jellyfish.
That's one of their main food sources. So maybe it's because of that with the brackish, fresh salt mixing up. Because
those little clear jellyfish get really, really thick. And then
they like those nutrients that are flushing down, and they get really accelerated population bloom.
There you go, because you don't really get a lot of that out of Placita.
Uh-uh.
Not like you do up in the harbor.
Nothing like out there or up here.
Huh.
So that's the only thing that makes sense to me now that we're talking about it more.
That's a good point. But you ever want to have some fun with somebody from up north? You know, make sure they're not allergic to bee stings, because people that are often allergic to bee stings have bad reaction to saltwater creatures, you know, stings from saltwater creatures. But if they're just a normal, healthy person, what we used to do is I would get one of those clear jellyfish, and your hand is tough. It won't burn your hand.
Right.
You can hold a clear jellyfish in the palm of your hand. It's not going to bother you. But if you get it anywhere, like in the crook of your elbow, under your arm, any of the softer, more delicate skin, it really starts to burn.
Yeah.
And the old wives' tale, you know, about the excretion of your body with salt water.
Right.
You know, that would make it better. No, it doesn't. You tell people to wash it off, or you could tell them the, you know, if it's in the crook of their elbow, you could try and sit there watching them while it's burning, you know, say, well, if you just do that on there, that'll help. And it doesn't.
No.
And fresh water doesn't help it. All, any kind of liquid makes it burn more.
Yeah.
If you simply take a dry rag and wipe it off, the burn stops immediately.
Yeah.
You know, and when you slap that jellyfish on there and you take it off, that residual will burn any of the delicate skin. Yeah. And it's not extremely painful, but it's hot.
Yeah.
And
it's just uncomfortable.
The cool thing about it is, as soon as you dry it off, the burn stops immediately.
Yeah.
And when I was first working on commercial fishing boats, you know, you get covered in these things. I mean, you're literally dripping with them.
Inside your shirt.
In your shirt, in your armpits, in your, I mean, you are covered in them. Because you're standing in the water trying to pull the nets up to get all the fish bumped in one spot so they can be scooped up, dipped into the boat. And you just have these things flowing all over you. Well, you get on the boat and the mate takes the hose and says, here, come on, I'll wash you off. You'll feel better. The burning gets more and more and more intense. The more liquid gets put on it, the more. And finally, when everybody's done laughing at you, jumping around, trying to clear your shorts out, get them outside of your shorts and everything, they hand you a dry towel and say, here, wipe off. And then the joke's over.
Right.
But, you know, I still do it to occasionally family members who come down that, you know,
there you
it's
go.
Fun.
I'm going to teach you a lesson. You'll like Uncle Frank a lot.
Yeah, I'm evil, huh? Yeah, Uncle Frank, he's fun. He's going to burn you with jellyfish.
Yes. Yeah, they'll remember that forever.
Yeah. So, and while he's laughing and falling down in the boat, you know, as you hop around.
Yes.
All right. No, don't ever do that. That's horrible. You should never do that. Never, ever, ever. That would be bad. So, that would be awful. And I'm laughing thinking about it. That's right. Just, exactly. God, I'm a horrible person.
Nah.
So, don't ever do that. All right. Let's see. A lot of sharks in the harbor, as you were talking about. How's the bonnet sharks?
None. I haven't heard of any.
So, you really want to use sardines, cut pieces of thread fin, mullet.
It's been working really good for a lot of those small black tips. There's been a serious influx of baby bull sharks this year into the canals. You know, I'm hearing of them in Gulf Cove. What's that? Cattle Dock going into South Gulf Cove.
Yeah.
Countryman Waterway, Triple Lakes.
The Port Charlotte Canal System, the Triple Lakes Canal.
We always hear about them all the way up. So that doesn't
literally the Riverside Campground.
Yeah.
I mean,
and they're 2 to 4
up
footers.
Past the Navigator.
Yeah,
all the way up river, all the canals, and people say, well, I caught it in the canal. I got a little black tip. I'm like, I doubt it.
Yeah.
Black tip sharks don't like being confined like that because they have to swim while they sleep.
Right.
And bull sharks don't. They can just lay on the bottom and sleep.
Right. And bull sharks have an ability that no other shark does, is that they have a valve in their system that they can actually close off and retain salt. That allows them to be buoyant and survive and transfer oxygen levels into their body from the salt water to the fresh water, versus other sharks cannot do that.
That's why they find bull sharks all the way up Mississippi. I think the furthest was Illinois.
Yep.
Which is pretty much as far as you can go into Mississippi.
Pretty much without getting to the Great Lakes, absolutely.
So,
you know, so they have very much an ability to survive way up there. So, versus black tips do not have that ability, plus they don't like confined quarters. So I would say 99% of them are baby bull sharks, and people don't realize when it's like anything born, you know, when it's born, the coloration tends to be much different until as it starts to mature.
Like the shark we thought of as Hitler was actually almost black.
Right.
It
yeah.
was so gray, it was almost black.
Right.
And it would swim out there, and you would see the shark, and it's so dark compared to any of the other sharks. Mm-hmm. And as it would come through, and you could always tell when it was hunting because its dorsal fin was so big. It was, I would have to say, 5-6 foot from the body of the fish up, 4 to 6 foot, somewhere in that range.
Yeah.
And it was kind of laid over, and when it would get excited on the hunt, it would just get real hard and stiff, and it's, you know, and you'd just be like, the whole fish get real excited, and that dorsal fin would stand up just straight as it could be. But it was such a dark, different color than I would have ever pictured a hammerhead to be.
Yeah.
So the extreme is, you know, very, very old fish get very, very dark, but the younger ones could be almost any color from
Right. Well, with the juvenile bull sharks, because I've even questioned a couple that I have caught in that 28, 30-inch range, they have very much a black spot on the end of the tips of their pectorals and their dorsal, and even the tip of their tail has a black spot, but also the leading edge of their pectoral fins get a little black line on them.
Kind of a smudge-looking thing.
Yeah. So they look like, honestly to me, they actually look like a prettier black tip. You know, it's kind of unusual, but when they're that small, they don't have
and
the rounding.
Who was naming sharks 100 years ago that the one shark that does not have black on all of its fins, where all the fins are not black tip, gets called a black tip?
Right.
It has one white fin by its anal opening. It doesn't have any black on it.
Right.
So the rest of them all have black tips, but that one doesn't. So why did that one, when the Atlantic sharp nose is all black tips?
Yeah, well, who named a silky shark? Because it feels nothing like silk. it's just a name, I don't know. But, you know, it's just surprising to me how many have been being caught in the canals this year than any years past, because there's always that occasional one that you hear about or somebody brings you a picture of. You know, every year there's a couple. But just in these last, 3 weeks, I don't think we've had not one day go by where one customer has talked about the 1, 2, 3, or even 6 that they've caught either off their dock or drifting around in the canals in the boat.
And I'm going to say this is probably the first year I can remember with this many reports.
Yeah.
More than, I would say, 4 times more than average.
Easily. I can't ever remember this many reports.
Do you think it's because we didn't have much rain and they all went up into the canals?
I don't know. I honestly really don't.
Excessive amount of small bait fish?
Yeah, but we've had years, you know, 20 years ago, the whole harbor was loaded with bait
fish. Yeah, but that would put them in the harbor.
But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't. Just this year's definitely, it's kind of cool because I'm happy to see it because it gives me a little bit of faith that we're still going to have some large sharks
yeah.
in the future. You know, granted that's 10, 20 years down the road, but still, it's a really pleasant thing to see because not ever seeing this in the past the way we are now is pretty unusual. But, hey, throw out a mullet out back. You think you're snook fishing, and don't be surprised if you catch a 3-foot black or a bull shark.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, and it just goes, you know, you and I have been doing this for, oh God, I don't even know how many years ago we started this. You know what? I could actually almost look.
Part, yeah. Quite a while.
Yeah. I honestly trying to think, and I think we started this in 2011, 12,
maybe
13.
I can't, I'm getting too old, it's all disappearing and blending.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, but it's still impressive, you know, with, you know, to see the sharks around, you know, along with some of the other species. I mean, it's like, you know, the snook out there on the wrecks, the snook that are out on the beaches, you know, this has been, you know, last year we had, you know, the river was at flood stage for almost 2.5 months by this time. And, you know, we had the bad red tide, the black tide, all that other garbage. Nobody really got to see any of those fish or catch any of those fish out along the beaches. And this year, we're lucky. We're seeing all these snook out there. Guys are, you know, like you said, taking videos of all the snook on the power pole reef in 50 feet of water. You know, it's pretty cool. And the other part that's starting to happen, too, is like right now, July, late June, and early July is when a lot of your resident Jewfish or Goliath grouper that are in the harbor and up the rivers and up in the canals that are now sexually mature are starting to leave to head offshore. because this is when they spawn. They spawn on a full moon in July, and they really do their major spawn in August. So we're starting to see guys are catching a couple of Goliaths in the 100-150 pound range while fishing the 20 foot holes right now for tarpon. Guys are seeing them cruising along the edges of the flats, you know, 150-200 pound fish just in 5 feet of water on the west wall or the east wall, all heading towards the passes. And then you have your mangrove snapper that are doing the same thing. You're getting your groups of mangrove snapper that are leaving the canals that are finally sexually mature, that are going to go do their spawn on all the offshore reefs on this next full moon.
2013, we did our first radio fishing.
Wow. That's crazy. So 6 years. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I noticed that we have, I don't know what happened to the page, but we're on the, this will be 612 shows that we've put up on radio fishing.
Wow. That's pretty impressive.
We've done all of them, but maybe 20.
Yeah, yeah.
So you and I have done right of almost 600 shows.
That's pretty wild.
So anyway, I had to go back, and I don't know why they're not all up where they're supposed to be, but I will fix all that.
Well, and you archive some and been playing around with it a little bit, so.
Yeah, but I think I almost screwed up a bunch, so I'll fix it. So gotcha. Anyway, it's just kind of amazing. The fishing's actually not bad right now here in the harbor.
Not at all.
Everything's going along pretty good. Robert and I, as end of our season, our season ends July 4th, so things slow down a lot right now. We're still doing Luigi's every month. We do Luigi's. You got to go on fishandfranks.com, hit the seminar button, because it's not a set week every
right.
month anymore, because we ended up giving up our time. We were out of it for almost a year, but now we're back, and we book through next year, and we have we'll be having the dates for all next year. We did book Reaper Rods to do two talks this fall. We've got Mark Nichols coming, we've got Doug and Mary from Strike King, we've got some of the biggest names in the industry. If I decide to go this week to ICAST, I'm going to see if I can find Jimmy Houston, see if he'll come and give some talks. Is there anybody besides Jimmy Houston I should talk to?
Mike Iaconelli.
Mike, oh yeah, you like him, right?
Well, he's a bass fisherman, and he does saltwater fishing a little bit, but he's just, from some of the younger generation to the older generation of fishermen, he's got like that.
So if I go to ICAST, you're going to have to go, because I don't know who he is.
A cult following. Jim knows him. Jim's super good with them.
So anyway, yeah, we're going to be having all the major factories here in our new seminar area, or older new seminar area out back, once all the tents have failed. I gotta rebuild all of that. I don't know what I'm gonna do.
We'll figure it out, like anything else. Ain't a big deal, not detrimental.
So anyway, boys and girls, a lot of cool stuff coming up for the year here at Fish and Franks and with the radio shows, and all kinds of other stuff. I really don't know. I mean, it's getting different again.
Yes.
But I'm going to say, if you're going to go out off the pier, what would be the best pier to go to?
Honestly, I'd say Placida or the Anger Pier up there in Minnesota, Inglewood.
Okay.
You know, those would be my two choices, just because of the variety of fish that they're catching off them. Snook, ladyfish, jacks, some small sharks, juvenile tarpon at night, small snapper. I mean, just you're gonna bend a rod. You just got to change things up. Start off with a small hook, small piece of bait, maybe throw out a couple chunks of ladyfish or mullet and see what comes along and takes it.
I'm gonna say up here in the harbor, Port Charlotte Beach is probably your best bet. A lot of small sharks, mm-hmm. some odd incidental other fish. Lashley with second place, with about 3 to 6 sharks a night coming off of Lashley.
Yeah.
Been doing pretty good.
Absolutely.
Kind of weird at Lashley. You just don't think of Lashley Park as a shark pier.
No, you don't.
I really don't.
But, you know, Gilcrest, you know, same thing going on there. You know, guys are catching them off of there, and you don't really associate that with a shark pier either.
Yeah, no, I'll go with you on that. Gilcrest is not big in mind. Bayshore, the one that always historically caught the most ones. But Placida, Anger Pier, and Englewood, Have you heard anything in Venice? We got a couple of seconds left.
Yeah, the Venice jetties have been doing very well. You know, in the early mornings, they're catching some nice mangrove snapper, a few pompano, and a couple Spanish mackerel. And then at night, there's been some really nice, nice snook being caught up there.
All right. Well, boys and girls, this has been Robert and Fish and Frank, and this is a show that we're not really sure what we're calling it, but we call it This Week in Fishing, and thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. From Robert, me, and RJ, who we still haven't found. We don't. RJ, where are you? He's around somewhere. We will find him eventually. See you guys. Bye-bye. Nothing wrong with fishing on Sunday at all.